Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Dr. David Adams joins us here in Studio A. He's Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. If you look on some church calendars, this day is for the remembrance of an Old Testament saint, Jacob. And Jacob is also known as Israel. He is the father of those 12 sons and who knows how many daughters. Four wives he had, and of those 12 sons, we have the 12 tribes of Israel. Ergo, his name, of course. He is an interesting character in the Old Testament. One might even say that if you include not only the story of Jacob and his twin brother Esau, and then the saga of his child Joseph down into Egypt, you got a better part. You've got a better part of the book of Genesis covered just with Jacob and that little novel at the end of Genesis that we call the story of Joseph. So why so much ink spilled over Jacob in the Old Testament? We're going to talk about that during this last hour of Issues, Etc. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Adams, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Great to be here, as always, on a bright, sunny day in St. Louis.
Oh, yes. Less true words have never been spoken. Let's set Jacob in his context, because one of the biggest obstacles that we all face with regard to the Old Testament is trying to keep everything in its timeline and everything in its chronology so we understand who fell when and what happened when.
Chronology is really only kind of half the problem, but let's start there. The traditional dates for Jacob are that he would have been born around the year 2000 B.C. I think if you follow the sort of the traditional dating, it works out to be about 2006, as the date of his birth. And then, again, following the traditional dating, would have died about 1859. So roughly 2000, roughly 1850 B.C., had a long life. What was happening in the world at that time? Well, that's a couple of hundred years before the Exodus, obviously before the Israelites were in Egypt, just at the time they were going down to Egypt. So setting the scene kind of historically there, in the ancient world, the dominant big countries at the time were Babylon in the east, and Egypt to the southwest of Israel. Now, something happened around 2100 B.C. that caused people all over the ancient Near East to begin to move around the country. There was a tremendous kind of shuffling, sort of like we saw in about 400 A.D. at the time of the fall of Rome, where all the people from Eastern Europe started moving west and south.
Mass migrations.
Mm-hmm. And the call of God to Abraham fell at just about the time of those mass migrations. So Abraham moved from Iraq. Abraham was the most famous Iraqi in history. So he moved from Iraq to ultimately what is now Syria, northern Syria, around Haran. And then from there, his family, or he moved, leaving much of his family behind, but he moved to Palestine, to Canaan, to what's now Israel, and lived there. Of course, he and his wife had Ishmael, and he and his wife didn't have Ishmael, but he had Ishmael as a son. Then he and his wife had Isaac, and Isaac later married and had Jacob. So Jacob is Abraham's grandson, born, as I said, around 2000 B.C. This was a time when Egypt was increasingly influential. Most of that part of the world, we think of Israel and Lebanon, was under the political and economic influence of Egypt at the time. So there's a lot of trading going back and forth. So when the Bible mentions that later Jacob and his sons go down to Egypt to get help from the famine, that was really kind of only a normal thing to do. It would be like people in a part of the world today that's economically depressed kind of going to America. It's the land of opportunity. Well, Egypt would have been the land of opportunity that they would have looked at the world and seen. It was the culture in which Jacob was born was largely the kind of culture. The cities were small. a couple thousand people at the largest in Canaan and Palestine. So most of the towns that you read about in the Bible in this period would have been little more than villages, a few hundred people, you know, in a couple of dozen houses, probably most of them without walls or anything, just living fairly peaceably at this time. And they would have been engaged in small animal husbandry. You know, they would have had, they weren't, often we make the mistake of thinking that Abraham and his family in the Old Testament were nomads, you know, like they were riding camels around. But that's not the kind of lifestyle they actually led. From archaeology and the literature of the Bible and other things, it's pretty clear that they were engaged in a kind of lifestyle that technically is known as transhumance, which means they kind of lived in an area and they moved their flocks maybe in the winter to one place and in the spring or summer to another place, but within the same general area, you know, just as pasturage developed. So maybe up in the highlands. Remember, Israel's a very mountainous place, so they might pasture their sheep in the mountains in the summer and then move them to the lowlands in the winter. But they really lived a pretty stable life. And so, this is something we frequently miss because the Bible just mentions when Abraham moves, but we and Jacob moved, but we forget that there are maybe 20 or 30 years there in between those moves.
And so what we're talking about is kind of a Bedouin lifestyle that they have, where they have a base of operation, and because they are, especially in Abraham's case, vast holdings in livestock.
Yes,
you have to move. You have to keep on the move. Otherwise, your animals don't live long.
Right. They can't pasture forever on the same grass. You can only eat grass once. Right, that's our motto.
You said only half the problem was the mm-hmm. chronology, failure to be able to put these Old Testament saints in their proper place on the timeline. What's the other half of the problem, curiously?
Well, the other half is the kind of things I was just talking about, the understanding the culture, the world. For example, this was a world in which writing was already known. You know, sometimes students ask, when we talk about Moses writing the book of Genesis and Exodus, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, students come even to the seminary with the idea that they picked up somewhere along the way that people didn't write at that time. They did. Writing goes back to somewhere between 3 and 3,500 B.C. in the ancient Near East. So they were already writing. They had already been writing. We have evidence of it for over 1,000 years by the time of Jacob. And in Israel, in that part of the country, writing came a little later, but it's clearly attested already by this time. So this is a culture that was that had a literature, it had a society, it had laws, and they wrote, they created literature. There were many different gods worshipped. The gods that were worshipped at that time were much like the gods of Greek mythology. That's to say, they were basically deities that were connected to the natural world. And most of the gods were understood to portray or to be connected to a certain part of the natural world. So the god that was the grain god, it isn't just that god was symbolized by grain, but rather that the nature of this god was sort of intimately connected with the grain, so that if the god prospered, the grain prospered. If the god was sick, the grain didn't grow. And this wasn't a symbolic connection, but they understood it to be a literal connection. And all of the worship of these deities was tied up with this sense of having to keep the natural order of the world going. We don't understand today how tenuous their existence was in the ancient world. You know, we look at the world, we're pretty comfortable in it. It's raining here today, and the weather's not too good. Probably the worst thing that's going to happen to me is I'm going to have to spend an extra long time getting home, or I might have a car accident. You know, if it snows a lot, I may have trouble getting to the grocery store, but I'm not going to starve. In the ancient world, they lived on the edge of starvation, of disease, of disaster all the time. And the most important thing in the religions around ancient Israel was keeping the cosmic order in place. And all of the religions, all the nature religions that were being practiced around Abraham and Jacob and those people were aimed at keeping the cycle of nature going. And that's why the religion of the Old Testament stands out in such stark contrast to the religions of the ancient world, once you understand what those religions were. Because religion of the Bible doesn't have anything to do with keeping the natural order going. It's really very different. And that's not readily apparent from just reading the Bible.
The first account of Jacob, not surprisingly, is that of his birth. And he's not alone in that birth, of course. He is one of two twins. We're given to believe probably fraternal twins, he and Esau. Give us the thumbnail sketch of the circumstances of Jacob and Esau's birth and why that is very important for understanding everything that will transpire from that point on in not only in Genesis, but in the Old Testament.
You know, when one looks at a book like the book of Genesis, you know, and actually begin to analyze what's there, you begin to see how, scholars would say, episodic it is. This is to say there are very few episodes, and then there are big gaps between them. So the book of Genesis, except for Joseph, you could argue that Joseph is different, but Genesis as a whole doesn't try to tell a continual life story. It picks out certain episodes. And this causes us to ask why certain episodes are chosen and included to try to understand that. In the case of most of the episodes in the book of Genesis, and this is true of Jacob and Abraham and particularly before Jacob, the primary issue is how the promise that God had made, first to Eve with regard to the birth of the seed that would defeat Satan, and then to Abraham and his descendants, how those promises were going to be passed from generation to generation. So in the book of Genesis, the question of which one of the sons will inherit the promise is one of the most important issues. And this brings us immediately into the story of the birth narrative of Esau and Jacob, because they're twins. They're born at the same time. And, of course, Esau is born slightly first, and they try a little ribbon or string around him to identify which one is born first, because much of the legal rights, property rights and so forth, were tied to birth position in the ancient world. So Esau was born first, and the point that's made with regard to them, one of the kind of the key thematic points in Genesis 25, beginning with verse 21 and following, is that Esau and Jacob were in conflict from even before they were born. And this striving between them is, and how it's resolved, is one of the themes that runs throughout the story of Jacob and Esau, really from Genesis 25 all the way through about Genesis 31, 32 there before that's finally resolved. So it's a major issue. It's emphasized very early on, and the fact that it's emphasized at the beginning of the story kind of is a signal to us that it's going to be important as the story unfolds. And so another sign of it is the fact that in verse 23 of chapter 25, we have a little bit of poetry in Hebrew. You know, anytime in a Hebrew narrative like this, you've got a little bit of poetry stuck in, that's kind of like a red flag that says, hey, pay attention to me. It's like we would print it in italics or double underline it in our text today. It's there, one of the ways they use to mark emphasis. And so the fact that this is poetry tells us this is going to be really important, and we need to pay attention to this. So the part that's in poetry says, in verse 23 of Genesis 25, two nations are in your womb, two peoples from within you will be separated, one will be stronger than the other, the older will serve the younger. That is to say, Esau in this case will serve Jacob. And so, see, right away, as soon as they're born, we're introduced to this issue of which one of the two sons will inherit the promise that God has given. And of course, we skip chapter 26 in the sense that it doesn't deal with Jacob and Esau. It goes back and picks up some more of Isaac's life. But what begins to unfold right away, the very next thing that happens after their birth in the story of Jacob and Esau goes right away to how they get, I'm sorry, even before that, and still in chapter 25, We get Esau selling his birthright to Jacob, and then right away in 27, Jacob tricking his father Isaac with regard to the blessing.
Now, the name Jacob seems to be, at least according to the narrative here in verse 26 of Genesis chapter 25, directly related to the circumstances of his birth. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. What's the point there? Because that does not come across at all in English, of course.
Right. This is a typical kind of play on words that occurs in the Hebrew Bible. This is the Hebrew writers in the Old Testament love to do this. They pick names and explain names in ways that are going to be, I'll say, spiritually significant, but they're kind of thematic. It's sort of like the way that we name our dogs and cats. You know, we don't name our kids the way they did in those days. You name your kid, your child, something that either a name you like or a traditional family name. They gave them a name that somehow reflected either what they hoped their character would be or what they discovered their character to be. Sort of like, you know, if I have a cat at home, it's a gray cat, and so I named it Thingol because I'm a J.R.R. Tolkien fan. I know that in Elvish, Thingol means gray cloaked. So I gave him a name that means gray. He wears a gray cloak because he's a gray cat. And people have dogs, they name them Spot. And so forth. Well, the name Jacob comes from a Hebrew word that has to do with conflict. So the Hebrew word, you see, the name Jacob reflects the fact that he's going to be a man of conflict, of struggle his entire life. That plays out in the story of Jacob. If you go through and look and sort of map out his life, he's always kind of fighting with somebody about something, struggling with, or most of his adult life anyway.
And the conflict spills over into his family as well, wherein we get the rest of the narrative of Genesis after the Jacob saga. We get the whole Joseph thing. We're talking with Dr. David Adams about Jacob. He's Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Feel free to give us a call with a question or a comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Speaking of phone calls, Bill is waiting in his car. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thanks. In the account where Esau sells his birthright to Jacob, I've wondered, could there have been any kind of documentation or ritual involved between the two to sort of make it official? If there weren't, well, then Esau could have just said, well, Jacob lied about it. I was just wondering what they didn't mention, well, to notarize, as it were, these kind of transactions.
Bill, good question.
Yeah, there could have been. There are records of, you know, transactions and wills and things like that in the ancient world. So there could have been. Chances are there was not, though. This appears to be a private deal between Esau and Jacob in chapter 25, having to do with the birthright. Because, you see, the reason I say that is because their father didn't know about it. And that's the whole point when we get to chapter 27 with the giving of the blessing. You see, Isaac didn't know that Esau had sold his birthright in chapter 25. And so after Jacob tricks Isaac into the blessing, then Esau comes back and he says, I'm looking at chapter 27, verse 36 and after, right in that area, Esau complains about how his brother, in verse 36, he said, he deceived me two times. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing. And so, you see, Isaac didn't know about this. He didn't, if he had, because the birthright and the blessing always go together in the ancient world. If Isaac had known that Esau had sold his birthright, his right, his legal rights as firstborn son to Esau, then Isaac would have had to bless Jacob, and Jacob wouldn't have had to deceive him.
Maybe this is the barrier of our sensibilities today, that we do not understand, even without written documents and notaries and contracts and lawyers, that in this culture, an oath, there's a sworn oath at the sale of the birthright, and the father's strange reaction that he says, you know, what's done is done. I can't bless you. I can't bless you because I've already blessed the other one. Seems a system with which we are very unfamiliar.
No, that's right. It is. I mean, the whole idea of, you know, of property rights as they were done in the ancient world is kind of foreign to us anyways. You know, why should it matter so much that birth order, you know, is the thing? But their idea was that the child who was born younger was born when the father was stronger. And so he has more of the father's vitality than the older child. That's the kind of mental world they were working with. And so the way they kind of thought about things was that the younger child was sort of naturally superior. No, you wouldn't quite say, I suppose we might say genetically superior to the latter child. And so the property, the rights all went with the older child because that was the one who was the best, that is to say physically, intellectually, and so forth.
So dad had a certain amount of vigor.
Right.
And the majority of it was spent upon the first child.
Well, the idea, you see, of course, we all know you're younger, more vigorous, you know, in youth, and as you get old like you and I are, you know, I go to bed at 9 o'clock now.
Yeah.
Of course, I get up at 5 in the morning, but I don't stay up all night like I used to because, you know, I get tired. I want to go to sleep.
Now, this incident, the incident that begins with the sale of the birthright, and then ends with Isaac's death, at which Jacob receives the blessing and the inheritance rights, and Esau essentially goes away empty, not with a curse per se, but with a lower position than his brother, immediately sets the stage for the next event, which is Jacob has to run.
Yes.
Tell us the story.
Okay, well, after the sale of the birthright, the story kind of skips forward here. We skip over Isaac and his relationship with Abimelech intervening, and we come back to the blessing in Genesis chapter 27 we've been talking about. And there was a lot of hostility there. As I pointed out in verse 36 of chapter 27, Esau says, "You know, isn't he rightly named Jacob because he deceived me?" You know, and again, Jacob, the name can mean, one of the things it can mean is to be deceitful. And so he's going to play on words there. So there's a lot of conflict between Esau and Jacob. And as a result, Isaac, the father, realizes maybe the best thing to do is to get Jacob off the scene here. And he advises him to go, or instructs him, actually, his father, to go and to take a wife from among their kindred, their distant relatives who still live up in the north in Haran. Haran is a couple of hundred miles north and slightly east of Israel in what would now be northeastern Syria up there. And they lived up there, and he wanted to go back where they were living, where their distant relatives were, and not marry one of the people right in this area. And so they do that, and that sets the stage for what happens next in Jacob's life, the next kind of conflict that arises.
The amazing thing about this, I remember studying Genesis, the narrative of Genesis, as a story,
mm-hmm.
As a plot that unfolds. And the irony here is very thick by the time you get to, chapter 29, where Jacob is now seeking a wife at his father's instruction, and the deceiver ends up becoming the deceived.
Yes.
And this seems to be a pattern for Jacob's entire life. When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. David Adams about the Old Testament patriarch Jacob. He's associate professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Have you noticed that Christian preaching today is sounding more and more like a how-to manual? Have you noticed less real preaching and more pious platitudes? Have you noticed that real Bible study has been replaced with moral lessons? What's missing from so much preaching today? Learn about the proper distinction between law and gospel in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes. To order our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on God's No and God's Yes, the proper distinction between law and gospel. issuesetc.org. Fire Breathing Dragons, legend or fact?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the fascinating book, The Great Dinosaur Mystery Solved. Well, Ken, we've all heard the legend of St. George and fire-breathing dragons. So do you think dragons actually existed at one time?
You know, almost every culture around the world has legends of dragons. Even the Bible mentions dragons in the Old Testament, in fact, a number of times. And the book of Job talks about a dragon that actually breathed fire. What's fascinating is that the descriptions of many of these dragons are remarkably similar to what we know about dinosaurs. Some were huge beasts, some had long necks, some with prickly spines, and some that could even fly. Now, it's true that these accounts sometimes contain embellishments, but I don't think the stories of fire-breathing dragons are just myths, because the Bible talks about such creatures. The Bible mentions dragons that lived in the sea, on the land, and flew in the air. And we now know that dinosaur-like animals did once live in the sea, like the plesiosaurus, and on the land, like the tyrannosaurus, and flew in the air, like the pteranodons. I think the dragon legends are real stories based on people's encounters with dinosaur-like animals. You know, as a Bible-believing Christian, I'm just not surprised at all.
We may have many surprises for you about dinosaurs in our free booklet, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs? It's written by Ken Ham, and it's available free on our website, AnswersRadio.com. Many other free booklets are there for you to download. That's AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. On talk shows, politicians are frequently the topic of rude jokes. In movies, political officials are often selfish and corrupt. Such portrayals of politicians can mislead our children to think that everyone in government is corrupt or stupid. It is important that our children are not misled by these messages. The Bible tells us that government is a blessing from God. Politics is an honorable profession, and there are many fine people working in our political system. Teach your children not to be misled by the many negative portrayals of politicians in the media. God loves us so much, He sent Jesus into the world to die for us. He has also blessed us with many good political servants who seek to do His will. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at www.cmli.org.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, www.bethanylcms.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. David Adams is our guest. Our conversation will continue in just a moment. Before we do that, folks, I want you to stop and just think about the three topics that we've had already in just this 3 hours of Issues Etc. today. We started out talking with Tom Baker about law and gospel, the two great doctrines of Scripture. We spent another hour then talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery about gay marriage, getting his legal expertise applied to that dilemma in our society. And now we're right in the middle of a conversation on the Old Testament patriarch Jacob with Dr. David Adams. Where else will you hear this kind of coverage of all these topics in 3 hours on Christian radio? We strive to bring this whole variety, that's why we call ourselves Issues Etc. We strive to bring all of this together in a way that is not only informative to you as our listener, but also ultimately Christ-centered, where Christ becomes the message through all of the topics that we deal with. Now, if you'd like to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused outreach of Issues Etc., we have a Reformation Club. It's a new monthly giving club at the level of the confessor, the apologist, or the reformer. As a confessor, for $25 a month or an annual gift of $250, we will send you as a token of our thanks an Issues Etc. journal subscription, an Issues Etc. tape of the month, and the book by Craig Parton, The Defense Never Rests. At the level of the apologist, for $50 a month or an annual gift of $500, you'll have all the benefits of the confessor level plus a quarterly Issues Etc. book of the month. That's 4 books throughout the year. And then at the level of the reformer, as a token of our thanks, for a $100 per month gift or an annual gift of $1,000, all of the confessor and apologist benefits, 3 Issues Etc. journal subscriptions, 2 Issues Etc. tapes of the month, a written transcript of each Issues Etc. tape of the month, and each and every Issues Etc. book of the month. That's 12 books for the year. Now, you can join our Reformation Club, or you can give any gift to Issues Etc. by credit card. Call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. You can also donate by check. Write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. You can also now donate online at our website, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org. Just a reminder that Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, but we are not funded by the church body. We are entirely listener-supported. We're also not associated with the Lutheran Layman's League or Lutheran Hour Ministries. We're supported by you, our listeners.
Can I jump in here for just a second,
yeah,
Tom, before we get back to Jacob?
Absolutely.
When you were talking about the Reformation Club thing, it struck me, when I was in Washington, I used to do probably a couple radio programs a week on different radio stations, sometimes here for KFUO, but often for other Christian radio stations as well. And I was just struck while I was sitting here of how, I suppose listeners to KFUO don't realize how really unusual it is to get this kind of programming that's thoughtful and sort of not just haranguing and beating people over the head, but trying to address issues in a thoughtful, constructive way, rooted in the Word of God, and shaped by the theology of the Reformation. So, I just want to say thank you to you and to everybody who works in producing Issues, etc., but also in saying that, add my wish that all of the listeners to this program would join in supporting this ministry, not only Issues, etc., but all the work that goes on here at KFUO, because you really don't realize how unusual and remarkable it is to get this kind of programming in this day and age, where in Washington, I was always on radio programs, and it was always the Chicken Little, the sky is falling, let's build everything up to a hysterical level so we can ask for money. But to have a chance to sit down and discuss something rationally and thoughtfully, that's rare.
Yeah, we generally try to avoid asking for money through the means of hysterics. That's why we call ourselves Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian. Thank you very much. I appreciate your vote of confidence there. Let's go to the phones before we continue with our conversation. Jeff is calling from his car. Jeff, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, I was just wondering what was meant by the scripture verse, Jacob I love, but Esau I hated? What did God mean by that?
That's a great question. I was not going to ask that, but I'm glad he did. Tell us about that, Dr. Adams.
Okay. First, we need to kind of understand what's meant by these terms love and hate in Hebrew, because they don't necessarily translate the way that we think of them in English. To hate, for example, in the Hebrew word sana, which means to hate, really means simply to be in an adversarial relationship with someone, sort of to be in conflict with them. It doesn't imply the kind of personal dislike that we often think of when we hear the word hate. For us, hate is a very personal kind of thing.
It's a visceral thing.
Right. And it implies a sort of intense dislike for you as an individual. The Hebrew word is simply kind of a statement of fact that we were in an adversarial relationship. We are in conflict with one another. So it doesn't mean, necessarily what we hear when we hear that term. Similarly to love, can also mean not only to, sort of feel emotionally bound to someone, but simply to be committed to them. I make a commitment to you. That's one way you say that in Hebrew is simply to say, I love you. So when God says, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated, and of course, what we're talking about is really that that God has preferred or chosen Jacob, not Esau, to be the one through whom the promise has passed. God has shown preference for Jacob. And this, in some ways, is uncomfortable for us anyway. We don't kind of like the idea of God showing preference, but God does. He chose Israel out of all the, out of all the nations of the world to be his people. Not because they were big or powerful or good, but in some ways because they were small and weak, so that he could show the greatness of his grace.
If anything, his quote-unquote favoritism is toward the undeserving rather than the deserving. Does it mean in any sense, that passage that Jeff had asked about, that God predestined Jacob for heaven, predestined Esau for hell?
No, it doesn't have anything to do with, this passage doesn't have anything to do with salvation, as we typically think of it, with that Jacob was saved and Esau was damned, or that Jacob was predestined beforehand to be saved. As it occurs in the Old Testament, it's a statement that God has chosen. It's almost equivalent to saying, I chose Jacob.
Now, so that we can get through Jacob's life before our time runs out, we need to talk about the incident that intervenes between Jacob leaving to find a wife and him actually finding not one, but two wives, and eventually a few more by the wife's handmaidens. The incident at Bethel, Jacob's dream. Tell us the story, and why is it so significant that it is included here?
Okay, the story is, first let me begin by saying that the account of what happens at Bethel is crucial for understanding the rest of the Jacob story. And what's crucial about it is the oath that Jacob takes at the end of the story. That sets up everything that's going to happen at in the rest of the story. So in some ways you have to interpret all of the rest of the story of Jacob in the light of this incident at Bethel. It's really the key, this dream at Bethel is the key event in Jacob's life as it's told in the Bible. So Jacob is leaving. He's going up north to try to find a wife. And he reaches a certain place, which we know now as Bethel, Bethel's about, if I remember correctly, a little more than a dozen miles north of Jerusalem. So it's there right in the central mountainous spine, a bit north of Jerusalem. And he reaches there, and he stops for the night, and he takes a rock, and he's going to sleep with his head resting on this rock. This sounds kind of odd to us anyway, right? But they did this in the ancient world. If you look at in Egypt, for example, they have these things made of metal that they used as pillows. It's kind of a U-shaped thing on a little pedestal that they rested with their head on. Every time I see one of those in a museum, I think, you've got to be kidding me. Why would you sleep? It looks sort of like a horseshoe on a little stand, a big horseshoe on a little stand that stands up maybe 4 or 5 inches off the ground. Why would you sleep with your head on something like that? I don't know the answer to the reason why, but they did, because they didn't have pillows of any other kind. So Jacob took a pillow, he was going to put his head on it and sleep. He falls asleep, and he has a dream, and he sees God standing next to a ladder and messengers or angels of God going up and down, apparently bringing messages from heaven to and doing the will of God on earth, seems to be the idea. But the important thing is not what he sees, but what God says to him. God says to him, I am the Lord, the God of your father, the God of Abraham. I will give you descendants and land. I'm summarizing here. In other words, he repeats to Jacob the promises that were originally made to Abraham. He then goes on to say that I will be with you. And God promises to be with Jacob as he goes on this journey and watch over him and bring him back to this land that he had just promised to give him. So in the end, Jacob wakes up, and then we get to verse 20 of chapter 28. These are the key verses here. Jacob woke up and made a vow, said, if God will be with me and will watch over me on the journey and give me food to eat and I safely come back, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone I've set up as a pillar will be God's house, and all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. So Jacob says that he will undertake to worship the Lord as the only God that he worships, that Yahweh will be his God. It was his failure to keep that promise that leads to trouble later on.
Now, he goes to his uncle's house, Laban, to get some cousins for wives, he ends up with not only, through a means of deception, not only the one that he desired, which was Rachel, but he also ends up with her older sister first, Leah, and then, in time, of course, as the story tells us, both of their handmaidens, four wives all said, ergo, we have the kind of the one father and the four mothers of the land of Israel. Not going into too much detail there for the sake of time, he eventually decides he will return because he's played a trick on his father-in-law, and his father-in-law is a little upset with him. And I wish we had time to go into the trick that he played because it's very interesting in and of itself. But he goes back. He's going to keep his vow and go back to his father's house in peace. And on the way back, he meets God again, this time in very different circumstances in chapter 32, verse 22. Another well-known Sunday school story.
Yeah, but before we get to that, there's a little detail in the text that we need to kind of file away in the back of our minds.
Okay.
That is, as he was leaving to go back, his wives get a hold of the household gods, and they steal them. They bring them along. Okay, file that away, because that's going to become important later on, the fact that he has and is apparently worshiping. Well, the story doesn't exactly say that, but that's kind of clearly implied later on, that he's worshiping these other gods. Okay, so now he comes back. He comes back, as you said, his flocks increase. He lives there many years. He prospers. In other words, God does all the things, if we note the story in chapter 28, God does all the things that he said he would do. He protects him on the way. He gives him food. He guides him. He prospers him, causes him to prosper. So God is keeping his part of the promise that he made. And so Jacob now flees to come back. There's more deceit, more trickery, more conflict here. Jacob flees to come back. Laban pursues him, they have discussion about these household gods and so forth that were borrowed. And now coming back, gets back to the land in chapter 32, and he realizes that he's going to have to face Esau again. And he also comes to the land and prepares. He crosses the brook there. And this is where he meets God in chapter 32, about verse 22. Jacob he divides his camp into two parts so that Esau can't capture everything of his in one time, so kind of protecting his bets.
He's expecting to actually fight with Esau.
That's correct. And so he goes awake, and he's lying awake at night, and he crosses the ford of the river Jabbok, which is on the, if you're looking, thinking of a map of Israel, it's on the east side of the Jordan River, flows out of the upper highlands on the east side into the Jordan River. So he crosses down there, and there he in the dark, he meets someone and wrestles with him. When the sun rises, he discovers the person with whom he's wrestling says, "Let me go. It's about to be dawn." Jacob says, "I won't let you go until you bless me." The man he's wrestling with asks him his name, and he says his name is Jacob. And then the one he's wrestling with says, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you struggled with God and with men and have overcome." And it turns out, Jacob discovers, that the one he's been wrestling with is no mere robber to take away his things in the middle of the night, but rather it's God himself who has appeared there. And so he gives the name of the place Peniel, which in Hebrew means kind of like the face of God. And he says in verse 30, Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It's because I saw God there face to face," another pun in the name, "and my life was spared." So Jacob realizes God's mercy in sparing his life. And so Jacob was blessed by God there. His name was changed. He goes on and meets Esau after that.
Now, this is, maybe I'm reading too much into the circumstances here, but Jacob is all worried about meeting Esau.
Yes.
I mean, he is making all the preparations he can to come to meet this brother with whom he is anticipating conflict. But he actually ends up meeting God himself, unexpectedly, and struggling with him rather than with his flesh and blood brother. Is there any significance to what appears to be a bit of irony injected into this text, that God would meet him and struggle with him, which seems to be kind of the hallmark of Jacob's life?
It is the hallmark of Jacob's life, the deceit, the conflict with Esau early on, with his father-in-law, with God here. But things begin to change at this point. And so when Jacob meets Esau, the conflict isn't there that he expects. This is really part of the blessing that God had given to Jacob. He promised to take care of him, to take care of him when he comes back. And so God has, I suppose we would say today, worked in Esau's heart to reconcile Esau to what had happened earlier in his life. And so Esau no longer holds a grudge. And in fact, he says, they get along together and are hugging one another and happy, and they kind of go each their way. And Jacob settles in the city of Shechem there. So the conflict that he expects to have, he doesn't have. But there's more conflict around the corner, because once he settles in the land, he starts to have conflict with the people who are living there. And so in chapter 34, we get his daughter, of whom we learn nothing earlier in the story, where does daughter come from, but the Bible doesn't record all the details. It only records the ones that matter for the story at the moment. So we're not told of the birth of Dinah or any of Jacob's daughters until they're needed for the story. So we have Dinah here, a daughter, and she is raped by the men of Shechem. And so two of Jacob's sons then slaughter the men of Shechem as a result.
In a move of deception, by the way.
Yes, that's right.
They say, you can pay us back by being circumcised. They say, okay, we'll do that. And then while they're still in their pain, they swoop down on them and kill every last one of them.
Yes. Now, the part of what's happening here is, remember what Jacob promised to do if God blessed him and took care of him and brought him back to the land? Jacob said, all the way back in chapter 28 we were talking, Jacob said, God, if you do this for me, what will I do? He said, I will come, Yahweh will be my God, and I will come back here and set up a place of worship. And I'll give you a tenth. So what did Jacob actually do when he returned? He didn't fulfill the vow.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, he didn't. So part of the conflict now, you see, is the conflict with God that begins when he meets him at the brook sort of continues, because Jacob doesn't keep his vow. And so things start going badly for him.
And there's this account again of a renaming in chapter 35, where God again encounters Jacob and sends him back to Bethel.
Yes, that's what I say. And now we get kind of the resolution of that part of the story. In chapter 35, things have been going wrong for Jacob. See, things always went right for Jacob. No matter, he was always in conflict, but things always kind of went his way in the end. He's one of these guys that everything seemed to work out for him. But now he's come back, and things aren't working out. He's living in conflict. He's got family problems here. His sons are turning out to be violent and as deceptive as he was. And so God then appears to him in chapter 5 and says, go up to Bethel, build an altar. He doesn't say it, but the implication is, do what you promised you would do.
He does say, put away the foreign gods that are among you and purify yourselves and change your garments.
Right. You see, Jacob had promised that if God took care of him, that he would worship the Lord. And he hasn't been doing that. He's been worshiping other gods. And so God comes to him and says, in effect, says, you made a promise. You haven't kept it. Keep it.
If you know anything about the Old Testament, it immediately becomes apparent now that we're going to be following these 12 sons of Jacob, the line of the Messiah as it traces its way through his family. This becomes the perennial problem for the children of Israel: idolatry, mm-hmm. worshiping God and also the gods of the nations around them, doesn't it?
It does, and it's interesting in that regard that this encounter between Jacob and God at Bethel is the first time that one of the people will identify as being the Israelites take an oath to worship the Lord as their God. Now, it doesn't occur in the Bible before that.
Up to this point, they simply worship the Lord.
Right. Well, Abraham did. We don't know about really anyone else. Of course, Noah did. The first part of Genesis is very spotty. But this is kind of the first time that this issue of worshiping the true God and the true God only arises in what is going to become the people of Israel. So you're right. In a sense, you see, this is the emergence of a theological theme that's going to dominate the rest of the Old Testament. Now, if there's a single thing that dominates the Old Testament, it's the exclusive relationship between God and the people that he's called to be his own. And it starts right here in the Jacob story and continues really for the rest of the Old Testament. We see it emerging, you know, as a concern on God's part, again, here in chapter 35. God holds him to his promise, just like he holds Israel later on to the promise that he made.
With less than 2 minutes before our time is up, Dr. Adams, what can we learn then here? We are so far removed from these customs, the legal technicalities that seem to play so heavily into this story of Jacob, the world he lived in. We are so far removed from this in geography and in time. What is there for the Christian in the 21st century in what God delivers to us of the Old Testament Saint Jacob?
Well, first and foremost, I think we're a long way removed from it, but we're part of the same story. Jacob is part of our history and our story as the people of God. You know, we might think of it as a Jewish story, but in fact, the church is the new Israel, the true Israel. Mm-hmm. Jacob is our true father, our true ancestor, maybe not biologically, but at least in terms of the way God views things. So Jacob's story is our story. It's our history. But more than that, Jacob is part of the means through which God delivered the promise of Jesus who was to come. The promises that God made to Jacob are fulfilled partially in Jacob's life, partially in the life of Israel, and ultimately culminating in Christ, who became the means through which we are incorporated into God's people and become part of that promise of descendants. So this is our story, not only historically, but most of all, it's the story of our salvation as well.
Dr. David Adams, thank you very much for being our guest. Dr. David Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Tomorrow on the program, a two-hour conversation with Greg Kokel on the art of Christian debate. Don't miss it. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.